According to my dictionary, the word pain is derived from the Latin word for penalty or punishment. When we feel pain, especially pain that does not go away, a form of punishment barely begins to describe the experience. On this week's Please Explain, we're going to talk about the types of pain and the basic science of pain, how we experience it, and the ways in which it is most effectively treated. And joining us are Dr. Denise Chow, Assistant Professor of Neurology at the Columbia University Headache and Facial Pain Center, and Dr. Jing Wang, Assistant Professor of Anesthesiology at the NYU School of Medicine and Director of Research and Education at NYU Langone Center for the Study and Treatment of Pain. And we are inviting our listeners to join the conversation. If you have a question, give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org, and you can also ask a question on our Facebook page or on Twitter. We are at Leonard Lopate. So let's begin with you, Dr. Chow. Should I assume that pain is experienced differently by each of us? Is there a standard clinical definition of what pain is?
So pain is definitely experienced differently by each of us because it's a subjective sensation. I guess the clinical definition of pain is the abnormal or an unpleasant sensation induced by injury to an organ or to tissues or potential injury.
And Dr. Wang, how does pain make itself known in the body? What's the basic mechanism for the message of pain to travel to the brain from where the hurt begins?
Sure. When I think of pain, I think of it as kind of a complex experience that includes a sensory component, often known as nociception. And that informs us how the location, the duration, intensity of pain. But you also pain also has other components, such as emotional component for pain that makes us feel upset, depressed, maybe anxious. And finally, there's a cognitive component for pain. Now, to answer the question, how pain goes from hurt to the brain,
it goes down a nerve, just like
sure.
We'd imagine, like some kind of electrical impulse?
Absolutely. That is what we think of as a nociception, and that pathway is actually pretty well understood. So what happens, you have, let me give you an example. When I put my hand on a stove, I feel pain. And what happens there is the temperature triggers, activates certain receptors on a nerve that innervates my finger. And once these receptors are activated, then that triggers the entire nerve and then allows a kind of a conduction of a current along the nerve that goes to the spinal cord and then activates another nerve in the spinal cord, which then activates another nerve in the thalamus in the brain.
And it moves very quickly, doesn't it, Dr. Chow? I mean, it sounds like a long route, but it's immediate. Where in the brain are pain messages received, and what happens when the brain receives a signal of pain?
So the main sensory processing center in the brain is something called the thalamus. That is where the pain signaling goes from the spinal cord first in the brain. And then from there, it relays to the somatosensory cortex, where the brain then perceives it as actual noxious stimuli, as physical pain. There's also activation of an area called the anterior cingulate, which is in the frontal lobe of the brain. And that is actually tied in with the limbic system, which is the system involved in emotional processing of pain. So that's where patients can also experience the subjective and the emotional consequences of having physical pain.
Well, what is the process all that different if you have a headache, a stomach ache, you bump your knee, or you cut your finger?
It is very different. So headache pain, which is my special area, has different mechanisms that underlie it, as opposed to when someone gets injured with a paper cut or it gets a bone broken.
Is a headache starting in the brain and then just staying in the brain?
So headache does start in the brain. A headache can be both just abnormal pain sensation as well as sensory processing disorder. So, for example, migraine pain, which is typically a throbbing pain around the eye or in the temples, can be associated with sensitivity to light and noise, smells and nausea, or sensitivity to movement. So it's not just a physical pain sensation, but it's also a sensory processing disorder.
And it's different than if you cut your finger.
Right, because when you cut your finger, you don't necessarily have, you're not annoyed by bright lights or loud noise, or you're not vomiting or nauseous.
Dr. Wang, there are very particular nerve fibers that specifically register pain called the nociceptors?
Nociceptors, sure.
How do they work?
Well, so the way our nervous system is organized is we have the brain, which is kind of the command center, and then we have the spinal cord, which are kind of like the motor or sensory extension of the brain. And from the from the spinal cord, then you have these other nerves that goes all the way to our fingers, our stomach, our toes. And some of these nerves are motor, and some are sensory, some called sensory information. Among the sensory nerves, you have a class of nerves that are what we call nociceptive fibers. What they do is their main function essentially is to conduct the sensation of pain. And they're the ones who express these pain receptors that I mentioned earlier, that once a noxious stimuli hits, these receptors then open and then conduct the
And it's important for us to experience the pain to know that something's gone wrong.
Absolutely, yeah.
We often hear of people having different thresholds for pain. Do different people experience pain differently? One person might consider something to be extreme pain and another person see it as a little more moderate?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are many places where this threshold mechanism can occur. And if we just review the neuroanatomy, you can see that the threshold mechanism can occur at the level of the nociceptor. So you certainly need a certain number of receptors to be activated by the painful stimuli in order to experience pain. And some people may have more receptors, and other people may have less receptors. Some people have slightly different receptors and that don't respond as well to pain stimulus, et cetera.
Well, you say people, but do animals and plants have nociceptors?
Well,
I've heard fruit flies too.
Absolutely, yeah. Actually, you know, the pain receptors were first discovered in fruit flies, so they do express these receptors. Now, plants express different receptors that are somewhat analogous and similar in structure, molecular structure. Now, whether plant feels pain—that's a different etiologic question.
My guests on today's Please Explain Look at Pain are Drs. Jing Wang and Denise Chow. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Dr. Chow, are there standardized ways to classify pain or categorize pain so that as a clinician you can zero in on what's happening and how to treat the problem in a methodical way?
Sure. So there are many different characteristics of pain, which when we're getting an initial history, it's important to elucidate. So one being the chronicity of the pain, whether it's acute, you know, just lasting for a few days or several months or years. The frequency of the pain, how many times it occurs during the day, how long each episode lasts for. The quality of the pain, is it burning? Is it sharp stabbing? Is it throbbing? Is it achy, dull, boring, vice-like? What factors make it worse? What factors make it better?
The nature of that pain, we feel it differently when if it's stabbing or crushing or tearing or some other source of pain or the heat, you know, putting our hand over the flame, even though the nerves are pretty much doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So how is that distinguished in our brain?
So there are different nerve fibers that relay pain in different ways. So there are some nerve fibers that are smaller and thinner and that they have more insulation, and those can relay signals faster. So that might be kind of a more sharper shooting pain. There's some pain fibers that integrate more deep sensory pain, and that can be as if, like muscle pain, for example, can be achy.
Or infection pain.
Correct, yeah.
What about when the pain goes away, Dr. Wang? Should people assume that the situation has improved?
It depends. It depends on, like Dr. Chow was saying, whether pain is the result of injury or pain is kind of an injury itself, in a sense. We see chronic pain patients sometimes, unfortunately. There's a kind of, because of the chronic painful stimulus, it induces a kind of a rewiring in the brain. So even when the initial painful stimulus is gone, due to the rewiring in the brain, they are kind of susceptible to further stimulus for pain. So
Well, we have endorphins that mask the intensity of the pain. That's so that we can continue functioning even though the pain is intense?
Yes, I mean, that's what the evolutionary purpose for this endogenous defense mechanism against pain is in our system.
Let's take a call. Peter from Hastings on Hudson. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. It has to do with endorphins, actually. What does it take? How much exercise? What kind of exercise to bring about the endorphin effect, if I can call it that? I'll take my answer off the air.
So endorphins bind to opioid receptors in our brain and spinal cord, and to induce a certain level of analgesia. It's not a quantitative thing, so exercise has been shown to induce endorphin release, as has other mechanisms and experiences. But there's not a 1-to-1 ratio. There's not a I can't say how many miles you can run in order to release enough endorphin.
But that's not a pain release of endorphins. But endorphins are also released when we have the sharp pain. We feel it immediately, and then it seems to subside, even though the problem remains. We're bleeding profusely.
Sure. I mean, that does happen, but endorphins are actually not typically powerful enough to provide analgesia alone. There are other mechanisms where we can feel less pain, even despite the injury. And our brain developed these descending inhibitory pathways. So there are centers in the brain. Their job is to provide inhibitory inputs from the brain to specific regions in the spinal cord to really block the transmission of pain signal.
Dr. Chow, I've heard that there's a nursing definition of pain. Pain is what a patient says it is, existing when they say it does. Do you think that's a good definition?
I think it is, because pain is a subjective phenomenon. So believing what a patient says, I think, is the first step of treating pain. And then dissecting what kind of pain it is the next step, and then how to treat it.
So getting back to threshold of pain, one athlete says, I cannot function, I cannot play. The next one with a similar injury plays through it. They say he has a higher threshold of pain. Is that subjective?
That is
subjective.
Or is
that biological?
But there are also biological mechanisms. Patients with chronic pain might say that they have had a headache for 30 years, so that they're used to it. They're used to having a headache all the time, but there are sharp exacerbations on it. But they can ignore the underlying pain. And there's a theory actually called the Gates theory of pain, whereby the brain can almost be distracted of processing painful stimuli by another stimuli. For example, if you are getting your teeth pulled without anesthesia, if you pinch your leg really hard, you can actually distract the brain, and you will actually experience subjectively less pain.
There's an old joke that if you have a pain in your fingers, have somebody step on your toe.
Exactly.
That's how it works, yeah. Another way to alter the pain threshold is to look at the emotional response to pain. So we've talked a lot about how sensory information gets to the brain, but that sensory information also gets processed into emotional information, and different people may have different mechanisms at processing that emotional information.
A lot of people have written in about back pain. Now, back pain is intermittent. Sciatic pain can come and go. Why is back pain so common?
So back pain is one of the most common chronic pain conditions. We see them a lot in our chronic pain clinic. There are several different kinds of back pain. There could be myofascial pain, which is really kind of chronic muscle sprain. And that's probably the most common. But you also have things like sciatica. Sciatica is really, it's a kind of a layman version for what we call radiculitis, which is an inflammation of a nerve that's exiting from the spinal cord. And because of the arthritic processes in the spinal cord, the nerve may be compressed or
it's
inflamed.
It's being pinched?
Yes, it's being pinched.
And so when you do something that compresses it, suddenly pain goes running through your
Absolutely,
whole body from
yeah,
your toe
yeah,
all the way up to your brain.
Well, yes, in a sense, yeah. It goes from
it
the
feels
toe,
that way.
Yeah, it goes along the toe to the nerve that goes into the spinal cord, yeah, and then goes to the brain.
Let's take another call. This one is from Esther from Highland Park, New Jersey. Hi, Esther. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering about the relationship between pain and anxiety. I've read from a neuropsychological point of view that infants experience them as the same thing, like there's no differentiation. And I'm wondering, like in adulthood, what the relationship is.
We see a lot of comorbidity between anxiety, as well as depression with pain. And that's the kind of a phenomenon that I'm describing when I'm talking about emotional response to pain. And yes, I mean, it can be very difficult to differentiate.
And Dr. Chow, emotional pains often manifest themselves as headaches, don't they? Or other kinds of pains in the head?
Sure. I mean, definitely stress and anxiety can trigger headaches, or having chronic headaches can also trigger stress and anxiety as well. So it's both ways. I mean, some people talk about what's called psychogenic pain, which I actually don't like that term because it, in a way, it discounts what the patient is feeling. It's just being something that the patient has made up in their mind.
Where they say it's all in your head.
Right. Well, it is.
But it is all in your head.
But there is a biological, underlying biological mechanism for their pain. And then, as I mentioned before, there's activation of limbic structures in the brain which process emotion that are activated when you have a physical painful stimulation.
My guests are Dr. Denise Chow, Assistant Professor of Neurology at Columbia University's Headache and Facial Pain Center, and Dr. Jing Wang, Assistant Professor of Anesthesiology at the NYU School of Medicine and Director of Research and Education at NYU Langone Center for the Study and Treatment of Pain. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is @LeonardLopate. Did I get all that right? I hope so. And we'll be back right after this. And we are back with our guests, Dr. Denise Chow of Columbia University and Dr. Jing Wang of NYU. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. One of our listeners wrote in, Sandy left this on our show page. She said, I tripped and fell during a run and landed on my hands and knees. The skin under my knee was torn to shreds, pieces of gravel stuck in the wound, but I had no pain. I was stunned and embarrassed, but no pain. It was almost an out-of-body experience. When I looked at the wound, I thought that it should hurt, but it didn't. The pain didn't start until I got home to clean it. What was going on? Do you know? Is this an endorphin thing?
Well, it's possible that the actual shock of the experience, the fall, might have blocked in a way her perception of pain at the moment until she realized at home what happened. Then the shock of the experience wore off, and then she began to experience pain. And also, there is there may be some delayed release of inflammatory mediators, molecules that are produced in response to injury that can have a delayed effect, and then in response will cause pain.
Now, a number of people have wondered whether posture has an effect on back pain. Does it?
Sure. You know, it depends on the kind of pain there is. Posture probably is going to not have a huge effect on sciatic nerve pain or on like what we call lumbar radiculitis, because the pain is usually the pain generator there is usually the inflammation around the nerve when it's exiting the spinal canal, and the pain is due to disc herniation. So posturing is not going to change a whole lot, but it will change, it will affect myofascial pain, pain as the result of muscle sprain and strain.
Well, I had what's called sciatica,
mm-hmm.
and every treatment chiropractor and I had, mm-hmm. I went to Chinese doctors, I did pretty much mm-hmm. everything, and it wound up physical therapy is what mm-hmm. got me through, and
Absolutely.
It changed my posture.
Changing posture does help. So does
well. I don't have the pain anymore, so something must have gone right.
So does exercise, actually. You know, light exercise.
Oh, I have to do that too.
Heavy weightlifting kind of exercise. A lot of it is really kind of remodeling your musculature and the way you function moving forward.
Well, what about treatments? First of all, let's deal with the most obvious ones, the over-the-counter treatments. They all seem to have slightly different effects, whether we're talking about aspirin, ibuprofen, acetaminophen. How do they differ in treating pain? Or can we use any one of them interchangeably?
There are definitely differences to different analgesics out there. So Tylenol, for example, does tend to be as effective for headaches as naproxen, which is Aleve. And this is because of different receptors that the medications work on, the location of these receptors in the body, and how specific medications are for certain receptors. So the combination of all those factors results in the differential response you see in terms of efficacy and side effects as well.
Well, Dr. Wang, what about non-drug remedies like ice or heat? Is one preferable?
It depends on the condition. So if in certain conditions ice is better and in other conditions heat is better. So for example, if you have muscle sprain, you know, sometimes applying heat will increase the blood flow through the muscles and allow the healing process to be faster. On the other hand, if you have acute injury when there's a lot of inflammation, it's better to apply ice to, you know, limit the amount of blood flow to the area where the tissue injury is occurring, and thereby to relieve some of the inflammation there.
I've read that evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins asked, "Why does pain have to be so painful?" I guess it's to say pay attention. Is that it?
Well, I think that's a great question, because I think another way to frame that question is why does pain elicit such a strong negative emotional response, right? I think part of it, from an evolutionary standpoint, like you said, Leonard, that pain should bring our attention, because often a good pain, if you think of it, is a pain that alerts us to tissue injury.
Well, I've heard that the pain of a burn is the most excruciating mm-hmm. because of its tissue injury over a large area?
No, that's part of it. But also, one way to look at pain is the mechanism for pain induction. So you have nociceptive pain, which is pain as a result of tissue injury. But there can also be inflammatory pain as pain as a result of inflammation. And the reason burn is such a serious pain condition is because it leads to both direct tissue injury, so triggering nociceptive pain, but also inflammation leading to inflammatory pain.
Dr. Chow, you mentioned earlier that sometimes people doubt that someone's really having a pain. Could we find out for sure if we did an MRI?
There are ways you can confirm pain, or that we know objective measures are associated with pain. So some of them are measuring certain protein, like proteins in the blood, which is really done more experimentally rather than clinically. Things like CGRP, for example, calcitonin gene-related peptide, is released when patients have pain, headaches, or other pain. Or nitric oxide is also released. In terms of MRI, doing a traditional structural MRI doesn't usually elicit patient's pain. But you can do a functional MRI, which basically looks at which part of the brain is being activated. And also you can do sometimes PET imaging to see which areas of the brain are receiving more blood flow. And there are definitely known structures in the brain that we discussed about that integrate pain. So if you see these areas lighting up, that can be a way to help confirm that a patient's actually having pain, and also even to help distinguish what kind of a pain syndrome it might be.
Earlier this week, a panel of experts at the FDA voted to toughen the restrictions on painkillers like Vicodin. It would limit access to drugs containing hydrocodone because of the high levels of abuse associated with them. Do you prescribe those kinds of medications?
We do, actually. Opioid medications are actually commonly prescribed in chronic pain patients, and particularly also in the acute pain conditions as well. Now, there is not a whole lot of great evidence, and it's very it's an area of a conflict, conflicting data, where whether chronic opioid therapy can actually improve pain in chronic pain patients. And because of the FDA is rightfully concerned about, you know, the potential for abuse, potential misuse and the lack of convincing data that that opioids do help with chronic pain conditions. So there is an area of controversy and an area of where regulation is regulatory bodies are closely examining.
So for terms of headache pain, I actually never prescribe opioids. I do think it's very useful and needed for other types of pain in the rest of the body, for example, back pain or sometimes nerve pain. But for headache pain, there's actually data that using opioids can actually interfere with the efficacy of traditional migraine medications because it acts in the same areas of the brain as traditional migraine medications does. And it also it can cause something called rebound headaches or medication overuse headaches, where in a way, the pain killers initially quiet down the pain receptors in the brain, but these pain receptors over time will upregulate, they'll increase, and then in response you'll need more pain medication, and then they'll increase, the fibers will increase more. So in essence, you've increased, called something called central sensitization, whereby the brain is more sensitized to experiencing pain because of using these medications.
So what happens with chronic pain? You keep on taking the medication. You might even start taking more because the pain is getting worse. Are you just, in the end, winding up being the equivalent of addicted to the medication?
Some of the patients clearly become addicted to the medications, but there's also another process called dependence and tolerance. Tolerance means a medication taken repeatedly over time loses its efficacy, and that's probably because of through a process like a receptor desensitization. So opioids bind to opioid receptors. Chronic intake of opioids will cause desensitization of those opioid receptors, making this drug work less well, and you have to take more and more to make them work again. So that's a process of tolerance. But you can also develop a process of dependence where you develop physical dependence on these medications, and if you don't take them, you develop withdrawal symptoms.
Now, what about meditation or even breathing? Mm-hmm. Can they help with pain?
Sure. Meditation, acupuncture, biofeedback, these are all mechanisms that, again, are in a way distract the brain from processing the pain. And also can, in general, just relax the patient. So I definitely advocate trying non-medication options as well.
Jason from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, I had a question about nerve pain. I'm a T7 paraplegic, and I experienced chronic, constant nerve pain to varying degrees, and just wondered the origin and alleviation of, I've tried Neurontin and several other nerve pain drugs to little or no effect.
And we got a Mike from New Jersey has written in with a similar problem. He's been experiencing severe nerve pain after several spine surgeries and wants to know if there are any ways to alleviate his pain.
So unfortunately, nerve pain, also known as neuropathic pain, is probably the most difficult pain condition to treat, because what we know about the pain, the activation of pain pathway, doesn't really apply to neuropathic pain, where the nerve itself is injured and probably chronically sends out the pain signal to the brain. Now, certain medications, can help with this syndrome. I think one of the listeners mentioned Neurontin, and it works by kind of quieting down the neuronal activities of those nerves that are injured, and perhaps also work directly in the brain to decrease the processing of brain.
But all of these things have side effects that we have
absolutely
to be concerned about.
Yeah, sure. Sedation, for example, is a common side effect. But there are other medications, there are other neuropathic agents that could be tried.
How can you explain phantom limb pain in people who've lost limbs? Why and how would a person feel pain in a body part that's no longer there?
That's another classic condition of neuropathic pain, actually, where the nerve is injured and possibly resected, and you don't have the pain receptors active anymore. And yet, because the nerve is improperly healed, it chronically sends out this information of pain to the brain.
A listener wants to know how long after you have experienced pain should you consult a doctor about it. She's been told that it's 1 week if you've had it before, 2 weeks if you haven't, and it remains severe.
I think it's a very individual answer. So if a patient has very severe pain that's lasting for several hours, that might be enough that they should go to the emergency room or to call for immediate medical attention. And it also depends on what kind of pain. So obviously, if you're having chest pain, that's something you need to go right to the emergency room because it can be a signal for a heart attack or something more dangerous. So, but if you're having, for example, chronic headaches, if there is interfering with your life at any point, I think that's the point that you should seek medical attention.
Hannah from Manhattan, you have to make it quick. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was recently diagnosed with fibromyalgia, and I believe it was a result of cervical spine surgery, C3 through 7. And what I'd like to know is how to differentiate, I guess, the pain from the fibromyalgia as opposed to some more serious pain, that it may be a serious condition.
So fibromyalgia, the pain from fibromyalgia usually comes from what we call tender points, and there are these classically defined tender points. They're symmetrical, they're throughout your body, and if you find pain that's outside of these tender points, then I would think that's probably something serious.
Thank you so much for your call. We go now to Jan. Hi, Jan.
Hi.
Make it quick, Jan.
Okay. Why would they prescribe gabapentin, which is an anti-epileptic or anti-seizure medication, to control pain?
So a lot of the anti-seizure medications can actually be very useful for nerve pain, for headache pain, not so much for muscle or bone pain. In a way, seizure is like a hyperactivity of the nerves and of the neurons. So there is abnormal transmission of electrical excitation causing seizure activity. And in a way, that's very similar to how nerve pain is. So it can be very effective in that way by dampening down the signaling and the transmission of the nerve pain.
In the very brief time we have left, when you first see a patient, how do you begin in your search for a diagnosis of the source of pain?
So I usually spend at least an hour, sometimes a couple of hours with a new patient. It's really about getting the history correct. So I ask many, many questions, and the patients have developed a questionnaire about the particular qualities and characteristics of their headaches, all the triggers. Sometimes I even ask them to graph it or to depict it.
Thank you both so much for being with us. Dr. Denise Chow, Assistant Professor of Neurology at Columbia University Headache and Facial Pain Center, and Dr. Jing Wang, Assistant Professor of Anesthesiology at NYU School of Medicine. It's been a pleasure having you both on our show talking about pain on Please Explain.
Thank you very much for having us.